Welcome to the iLife.com weekly podcast. I'm Sydney San Martin.
And I'm Matt Dodd.
And we're still here this week. sorry for the wrong numbers last week. We did record a podcast, episode number 5, and it didn't get published entirely correctly, or we sort of kind of forgot about it when we went to do the last week's podcast, the last week's episode. So
yeah.
We decided to make it 5.1, and we're back this week with episode number 6, and hopefully we'll continue numbering in order from now on.
Right. And sorry for the delay in the podcast. It is a day late. Normally record on Sunday. It's Monday, the 17th. So that was actually caused by me. I was participating in a ham radio contest called November Sweeps, which lasted until about 10 p.m. last night. So we weren't able to record. But that's a perfectly
legitimate reason for not recording a podcast. So it's a very cool thing to be doing on a Sunday night.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Anyways, though, so I guess we're going to try and be a little more organized with our podcasts, starting with episode number 6. And I guess we're devoting a section to just Apple news in the past week. This past Wednesday, Apple has actually end-of-lifed the old 23-inch Apple Cinema displays and the old in-ear earbuds, which were two announcements with the September and October, the laptop event for the display. The new display was announced with the mini display port, and in September, the new in-ear earbuds were announced, and both of which have not shipped yet. However, they both have been discontinued by Apple officially, and that means that they should be shipping to customers soon. In fact, I think that some people are saying that they're seeing preparing for shipment as of like early this morning. But anyways, awesome. Go ahead. That is something we were talking about last week. I believe the in-ear earbuds were announced, I believe, for an October release, and we're halfway through November now. So finally, they're shipping, as well as the mini display port, 23-inch cinema display. Note, though, that the 20-inch and the 30-inch cinema displays are still shipping under their DVI-based with the FireWire and USB hub and the older aluminum design without the glass. But only the 23-inch old Apple Cinema display has been discontinued.
But, that probably supports a little bit some ideas that new hardware is coming at Macworld with mini DisplayPort or DisplayPort, because at the moment, with that old one discontinued, the old one being discontinued has not changed the fact that the new aluminum cinema display, or the, what do they call it, the LED, the LED backlit cinema display, is still only compatible with the MacBooks and the MacBook Pros that were just released, so. They're moving the rest of their product line up before the laptops.
Yeah, I mean, don't you find it interesting, though, that they didn't update the 20-inch? People guesstimate that the reason they didn't update the 30-inch is because it's very hard to find a 30-inch panel, let alone find one that's LED backlit, because they're expensive. And LEDs certainly add more cost to the already large price for a 30-inch display. So that's probably the reason behind not seeing a 30-inch one, but 20-inch leaves question to Apple's logic. But
maybe. I mean, as far I see it as Apple wanting to kind of, at the special event, introduce the perfect pair of display and laptops and just introduce a single display that is your desktop companion for a new MacBook or MacBook Pro, and releasing a series of them in different sizes wouldn't necessarily fit into that goal. And let's face it, the 30-inch just hasn't really, I mean, it's not that popular in that kind of market, and
yeah,
it will definitely be refreshed eventually, but it wasn't really. No one would be buying. Very few people would be buying it right now if it had been updated.
Right.
Do you agree with that?
I do want to note. though I was wrong. The new one is 24 inches, not 23. So they discontinued the 23-inch one. The new one is 24 inches measured diagonally. So just a note. My little mistake, corrected it before.
All right.
It's too late. But yeah, also another interesting Apple news that actually came out late last week, and then today it launched, the Google Voice Search app. This basically takes your spoken words and send them over the internet to Google servers to be artificially analyzed, quote, into a data query, and then sent back to your phone in a matter of seconds. So you could basically launch this app similar to the other Google app that was text-based and just hold it to your ear because it has an accelerometer based control that determines the orientation of the phone and will only activate in the listen mode when it's next to your ear. So you put it next to your ear and you say the iLife, and it should return you a Google search for the iLife and get our website and such. But
it's pretty cool. I managed to download it just before we started recording this podcast, and I played around with it a little bit. And it works as advertised. And it's kind of funny. It works exactly the same way as Google 411. You hear almost exactly the same noises, including that fun little bleeping and blooping when it's trying to analyze what you're saying and searching for the results.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's really smooth. You either hold it up to your ear and it pretends it's a phone. The display turns off and it goes, you know, you hear a little ding and it starts recording. Or if you're wearing a headset or something, there's a little voice button, and you hit the button, and it shows, you know, start talking. You say what you want to say. It actually shows kind of a cool little waveform of what you just said, or have a representation of what you said. Well, maybe. And then after a couple of seconds, a little Google search page pops up within the app with your search results. And it does what it's supposed to do. I had trouble getting it to recognize me saying the iLife. It kept saying DIY or Hawaii, but still, you know, but it, for most queries, it should work just fine. Great alternative for Google 411.
Yeah, cool. Definitely interesting app. In other Apple news, there was some rumblings from Apple Insider about the possible change of case or slight change of case to the MacBook Air to make it lighter. They say that there's sources in Apple telling them that Apple is experimenting with carbon fiber and the MacBook Air to make it lighter. They apparently are toying around with replacing the bottom case with carbon fiber. So they'd keep the unibody design, but with it, instead of having a bottom case made of the aircraft grade aluminum, it would be made out of carbon fiber, and that apparently they could save about 100 grams off the weight of the laptop, which is 3 pounds or approximately 1,363 grams. So that would make it lighter, maybe look kind of cool with the sort of two-tone design that perhaps could match the black bezel, which the MacBook Air is interestingly enough missing. When you look at the notebook line currently, you see that the new MacBooks and MacBook Pros have the black bezel with the glass display, and the MacBook Air does have a glossy screen. I'm not sure if it's glass.
It has glass in the screen, but there's no glass cover. That's the distinction. There isn't a pane of glass covering it.
Right. But it's not black, so it's aluminum like the older MacBook Pros were. So I don't know. It would definitely be interesting, but the one problem with this whole rumor or change would be that carbon fiber is not nearly as recyclable as aluminum is. It uses a lot of chemicals, oftentimes used in epoxy to keep it together. It probably will never see the light of day outside of an Apple testing lab, but
yeah,
that is to be determined. It's definitely an interesting idea, though.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be cool, but I mean, one thing I see in this, I the bottom of a MacBook Air, making that lighter might shave off the last, you know, whatever the estimate was, you know, 100 grams, but it's a very small component. The bottom of the MacBook Air is just a sheet of aluminum that's been bended strategically and has screw holes in it. So it would be a little surprising to see Apple put a significant amount of effort into redesigning that piece.
Yeah. And the last bit we have on Apple News is the...
And this is news to me. I did not hear about this until about 5 minutes ago.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. Basically, it's that Apple has already purchased a retail space in New York City, which would be the fourth retail store, and that they just recently started up construction on it. So they've owned the space for some time now, about a year or so, I believe, and but they're finally just starting construction. So.
So yeah, I guess another store opening for us to cover if we're in the area. Hopefully it's not as crazy as West 14th Street.
Yeah, maybe they'll use some new crowd management tactics. That would be nice. But yeah, it's on the corner of 67th and Broadway, and if it continues at the rate it is, it should be expected to be opened late next year at the earliest.
All right, awesome. Oh, and here's one other thing, just in case anyone out there with a one of the new unibody MacBooks or MacBook Pros is out there and has not launched software update yet today or seen any of the Mac News sites, there's an update has been put out for a firmware update, actually, for the trackpad.
Ah, yes.
On both of those. And it should resolve some of the clicking, mostly clicking issues that people have been having, to put it simply. I talked to someone who got to play around with one of these things, and he did say that clicking was a little bit awkward on the new trackpad. So they're going to need all the help they can get from software, but Apple's usually pretty good with that. So
yeah,
people are definitely reporting that this new firmware update is helping. So if you have one of these computers, go out and get it. But a couple of people have reported also that they're seeing new problems after the firmware update, like the trackpad missing the first click. Well, the first time they put their finger down on it, and then if they try to click again, it registers a double click. We'll just have to see how that plays out, but definitely improvement.
Yeah. Also in software update this week, Apple introduced a update to Safari, Safari 3.2, yep, and it adds a number of things. Some improvements, probably a new WebKit build up to a certain point. But most importantly, a phishing features, anti-phishing features that alert you to when you're at a phishing site, and also a couple of new security measures that changes the way, you know, HTTPS uses...
It's the extended validation.
Right, yes, there you go.
Because actually, PayPal was starting to say that they were going to block any browser from accessing their site and from making transactions with them that didn't support extended validation. So actually here, some people may not know what that is. So open up a website you trust, let's say VeriSign, because they're one of the companies that's been really pushing this. We can go to HTTPS. The important part in this little example, :// say VeriSign.com or PayPal.com or whatever website you want to test this with. And Safari cannot... What the... And it's telling me that this certificate isn't valid. Oh, it's a bug in Verify. Okay, so make sure you don't forget the www in this case. VeriSign is not configured properly. And what you will see once you go to one of these websites, up in the top right corner of your browser, is not just the old familiar lock symbol. You'll also see in subtle green text the name of the company that you're visiting. And that is what's called an extended validation certificate. And they're more expensive because whatever company issues them, usually VeriSign puts a lot more effort into verifying the identity of the company that's requesting it, to make sure that whatever name they put up there in the corner of your browser is the actual name of that company and that it could not be confused with any other company. So when you go to big websites, you'll start to see that more and more these days, especially financial websites. And it's kind of interesting, you know, Safari introduced it a little bit grudgingly. It's not anything like the big, like an Internet Explorer, where you just have the whole address bar turns bright green whenever you're in one of these websites, or Firefox, where the little favicon area at the left side of the address bar expands into a big green thing with the name of the company. Safari just, you know, sticks it up in there in the corner, so you know it's there, but it's not really in your way. It's cool.
Yeah.
And I've managed to find a phishing site, which I'm not going to give out the link to, but I'm sure you will be able to find it yourself or come across it. And it's pretty cool. I'm not exactly sure how this works yet. We'll figure it out. But it looks like it's actually handled by Google. When you try to go to the site, it just does not load. It immediately pops up a little web page-like thing with a red bar in the middle of the screen that says warning, suspected phishing site. And I'm not going to read the whole error text, but then there are a few links. You can ignore the warning. The default action, if you just hit return, is to close the page entirely or close the tab entirely. And there are two links to report an error or learn more about phishing scams. And both of those links go right to Google. And they're definitely using probably similar or the same block list for phishing sites as the Google toolbar. For this, which is nice, and I'm surprised that Apple didn't put up a knowledge base article or something of their own. But it's a really cool implementation of anti-phishing, and it's very well integrated.
Yeah, definitely a nice add for Safari.
A very welcome improvement. I think that some people there were some big complaints about Safari that Safari does like absolutely nothing to protect people from phishing scams, and this changes that. So. Yay for 3.2.
Yep. So yeah, speaking of Safari, we're trying to divide the podcast into more identifiable sections, and Safari is a great segue into the cool stuff this week, for this week, because Sydney is switching from Safari to Firefox, and...
Well, I might be. We haven't decided that yet.
Well, he is for this week, at least. And so he can go ahead and share some of his experiences so far.
Well, sure. Basically, what happened is I was reading a post online. I'll say where I was reading Reddit one day, and I was looking around the Ask Reddit section, and I came across this post where someone had written and had asked the community, "What does Firefox have to do to get you to convert from Safari?" This guy was obviously a little confused that there was this amazing browser out there, Firefox, and yet some people, for some unexplainable reason, continued using Safari, and I'm one of those people, and I think you are too, Matt, right?
Safari. Yeah, I've been using Safari forever, still do.
And I started to try to respond to that post and say, well, I mean, I agree that Firefox is great. I use Safari, though, for a number of reasons. And I just kind of ran out of ideas. I had no ideas. I wasn't really sure. I just used Safari because, it was some unexplainable thing. So I decided to try to figure that out and use Firefox exclusively or as exclusively as I could for a week or so and try to customize it, you know, get tweak about colon config and install extensions, whatever I had to do to really make it my browser and to get the same experience as someone who's been using Firefox or the experience that someone who's been using Firefox and who likes Firefox would want me to have. And I'm still just a few days into it, so I don't have too much to say. But, I mean, on the whole, it's not that bad. And there have been significant improvements to it that since the last time I really seriously tried it that are pretty nice. I mean, it loads fast. It loads pages fast. It renders almost exactly the same as Safari, and the buttons and a lot of the little interface things and widgets in forms look a lot more like the ones in Safari and look a lot better than they did before. And it makes it a little easier to get used to. But there's still some things I don't like about it, and I will have to just play around with it and figure that out over time. And I'll get back to you in a couple weeks. with my verdict. But honestly, it really hasn't been that bad. I know diehard Firefox fans out there will be kind of slapping themselves in the face hearing me say it's not that bad, but it's good. I like it. But yeah, moving on though. You had an iPhone application that you wanted to share with us, right?
Yep. Night Camera is something I discovered actually quite recently to the recording of this podcast. And that's an App Store app that is meant for taking pictures at night. It helps you take better pictures at night. And how it does that is that it only takes the picture when the accelerometer shows the iPhone is still or reads the iPhone is still. So therefore making your pictures not all blurry and lights everywhere and all that kind of stuff. So it's a really nice implementation of the accelerometer to the camera, which I haven't downloaded it and tried it out, but it's 99 cents. And I'm sure it would help with taking pictures in low light situations, like at night. So it's definitely a cool thing to check out.
That sounds really cool because one of the biggest problems with trying to take pictures, especially on smaller devices, is that the very act of hitting the shutter button tends to cause you to move the thing around and make your pictures blurry. So an application where you can hit the shutter and then just concentrate on, or you know, try to not concentrate too much on holding your iPhone still and have it take the picture at the moment that it thinks best. It's great. Great idea. And let me tell you, the example pictures there, I don't know if those are indicative of the kind of quality of pictures that you will be getting out of it, are really crisp for night shots. So
yeah,
awesome.
And just as a side note, you can, if you're shooting on the iPhone, you can hold down the shutter button for as long as you want to stable yourself, but that does absolutely nothing in terms of once you let it go.
Yeah.
Whereas this app, I'm sure, will help you there. But yeah, we can definitely report on some usage of that once we get our hands on it. But another object or item in this cool stuff of the week is Open Radar. And that's also a very new service that launched, I believe, Sunday. So that was yesterday.
Yeah, Sunday afternoon, sometime in there. Sunday. The 16th.
Sydney, you've used it. I just read a press release on it, so
you can explain
it better than I could.
All right. Okay. So for those of you who don't know, Radar is Apple's internal bug tracking system. I hope none of this is supposed to be confidential. I don't think it is. Anyone can sign up for it. And basically, you know, you've probably seen Apple feedback, you know, apple.com/feedback, where you can submit feedback about your favorite Mac or about Apple stuff. Tell Apple what's wrong with it and what you'd like to see done differently. Just anything. And Apple actually does listen. They probably won't write back to you, but they listen and they use that advice to make fixes. But there is a pro version of feedback, and it's called Bug Reporter or Radar internally. And the idea is you write up a formal report that has to follow a specific format, and you send it into Apple, and they track it alongside all their internally created bug reports and notes and stuff, and it can have a lot of weight in terms of fixing problems. But a big disadvantage of Radar is that it's closed. Only people inside of Apple can access it. If you're outside of Apple and you sign up for an account, you can see what's going on with problems you've submitted, but you can only see what Apple wants you to see. So you may submit something, and then Apple will say, okay, thank you, we have it, and you will hear nothing else about it ever again. So the idea of Open Radar is to create kind of a second database alongside that that's totally open to the community. So whenever you submit a bug to Apple, whenever anyone submits a bug to Apple, you also submit it to Open Radar, and the URL of that is OpenRadar, you know, OpenRadar .appspot.com, appspot.com. And why not a tiny URL too? I don't have a tiny URL, do I? Yes, I do. Tiny URL 5WDETE. Anyway, so the idea behind Open Radar is you can finally look at all the bugs that are already out there and know if what you're submitting already exists. Or if you think you're having a problem with an Apple product, you can look on Open Radar and see if anyone else has reported it. It's very new. There are very few bugs up there, but it's growing very fast, and I'm sure within a few weeks it'll be, or within, you know, within months, within years, whatever, it'll start to be a very nice thing to have around if Apple doesn't shut it down.
Yeah, it's definitely it.
And their final little thing, they're releasing tools to help you navigate it. So, like, if you're the kind of person who feels ambitious enough to try to write bug reports to Apple, you will end up with a little application or utility you can use to simultaneously submit your bug to both places. And if you like to read bugs, there's also a little utility to let you click on what are called radar links. It's, you know, a link that's /radar:// which doesn't do anything usually for people outside of Apple. And when you click on a link to a bug, it will redirect you to Open Radar, and it will see if they have a record of that bug, and it'll show you whatever they know about it. So it's really cool. Just something to keep an eye on.
Yeah, definitely. Otherwise, I think that's about it for the cool stuff we have for you this week. But definitely we'll can report back to you on some of the stuff we talked about today, the Night Camera, Open Radar, and your experience in Firefox. But otherwise, I guess we'll move into our final section, which is the tip of the week. I don't know, Sydney, you look like you had an idea for this one.
Yeah, I made the section up because every once in a while I think of something, and we both do, that is a little just useful to know. And one thing that I kind of wanted to share recently and just want to get out there is that auto login, and this is the tip of the week, the official iLife.com tip of the week for the week of November 16th, 2008, podcast episode number 6, first time. Auto login is not secure. If you have sensitive stuff in your keychain, website passwords, email passwords, whatever sensitive stuff on your machine, don't use auto login. It's possible to get into any computer that auto login turned on to recover in just to see the password that to see your login password and to get into your keychain and get your keychain password and get all the passwords in your keychain. If you have auto login turned on, it'll generally require physical access to the computer. If you leave your computer unattended and someone else manages to get their hands on it, they could get into it. And this is not anything new. There are known methods for doing this out in the malicious world. So, auto login's fine if you don't have anything you care about on your computer, but just be really careful with it and absolutely never use it on a laptop if you plan for that laptop to leave the comfort of your locked house. Yeah. That it's a little bit of a sad and negative tip of the week, but I just wanted to get it out there, and we'll probably have more useful ones coming your way in the very near future.
Yes. But anyway, with that said, I think that wraps it up for this week. Again, we apologize for the delay because of the circumstances this weekend with me. But anyways, if you want to contact me, I'm Matt, M-A-T-T, at theilife.com. That's theilife.com. No spaces, obviously.
And I'm Sydney, Sidney, at theilife.com. Same spelling, I'd hope. And, of course, you can also check out our blog posts. You can comment on them, throw in your own opinions. We're always listening.
Yep.
And, yeah. That about wraps it up, I think.
With that, I guess that's it for episode number 6. It's actually episode number 6 this time. I'm Matt Todd. That's it.
And I'm Sidney San Martin. That's getting me a nice habit. Good night.
Bye.